ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Francis Ford Coppola spent $120 million of his own money on his glorious 2024 flop, Megalopolis. I actually quite liked it. Filmmaker Mike Figgis was there to capture the journey, and the result is a documentary that's out in Australian cinemas this week called Megadoc. Mike joins me to discuss it later this hour. Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso, and this is ABC Radio National's The Screen Show, where every week the best and most interesting filmmakers and actors discuss their work. Before we get to Mike, there are two films about parents and their children that I want to discuss. One is a drama about cross-generational trauma in a Palestinian family. But the first is a charming new film by Jim Jarmusch called Father, Mother, Sister, Brother. It's divided into three chapters, each one involving a pair of siblings and their parents.
Do you really only see your mom once a year?
Yeah, no, we don't really do holidays together.
Jeff, how's Cheryl? I mean, do you still even stay in touch or?
No, Dad, we don't.
Oh.
It's like they say, you can choose your friends and your lovers. You can't choose your family.
Father, Mother, Sister, Brother begins with a brother and sister played by Adam Driver and Mayim Bialik. They're a pair of sensible shoe-wearing East Coast types visiting their father, played by Tom Waits, who lives alone in a remote cabin. He seems a harmless and even frail man, but there's something slippery about him. And sister seems a bit more aware of his shtick than brother. If we fast forward to the film's third and final chapter, a pair of twins, played by India Moore and Lucas Sabat, both wearing black leather, visit the now empty Parisian apartment of their recently deceased parents and reflect on their unconventional transatlantic upbringing. The middle and second chapter involves two sisters, a bookish, almost androgynous woman played by my next guest, Cate Blanchett, and her younger, slightly punkish sister played by Vicky Creeps, who pay a rare visit to their famous novelist mother, who's played by a prim and rather distant Charlotte Rampling. All three chapters in this film involve beverages which are consumed as a kind of ritual: coffee, tea, and water. In this film, mannerisms speak volumes, and sparse dialogue is both funny and sometimes very sad. If you're a Jarmusch fan like me, this is an irresistible siren call back to the cinema. Cate Blanchett is coming up.
So how is everything? Well, it's all good,
yeah.
I hope.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, good.
I almost hate to say it, but my life's kind of been like a dream.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Good. That's great to hear.
And you?
Me? You know, ups and downs, but everything's it's good. I think. Yeah.
Cate Blanchett, it's a pleasure to have you on The Screen Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jason.
I can't start without referencing your turn in Coffee and Cigarettes. And this film, of course, involves similar setups around hot beverages. Did it feel like a return to familiar material all these years later?
To the hot beverage. It was an absolute homecoming working with Jim again after all that time. You know, I went back to Australia for 10 years and ran a theatre company with my husband. So we'd fallen out of each other's sort of creative orbit. And we hooked up in New York a few years back and said, life's short. And he was working on this film, which is deeply personal, very tender and quite a quiet film. And so when I read the script, he sent it to me. Oh, he actually wanted me to play a different character. I immediately said yes because it had been too long.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine this comes from a very personal place. I found it very touching, having lost one parent myself. It's a very gentle film but really, it really touched me and really connected with me. I'm curious to know which of the other characters he was he was thinking of casting you as. It wasn't Vicky Krieps' character, was it?
Yes, it was. I think probably because there was some echoes from the character I'd played, one of the characters I played in Coffee and Cigarettes. You know, he said he likes me in that mode. But there was something about the other character that I played, Tim, that I thought, oh, that's curious. I wonder who that person is. And I think that speaks to Jim's fluidity, you know, is that he's really, it's all about casting and who he's working with. And I think he wrote quite specifically for people, not just in the part of the triptych that I'm in with Vicky Krieps and Charlotte Rampling, which was heaven, by the way, but in all the vignettes, you know, I think he wrote with people in mind.
Yeah, because I, from what I've read about your upbringing and the sort of teenager you were, I was curious about whether you were tempted to play the Vicky Krieps character, who's the kind of these two sisters, is the sort of more outwardly rebellious one.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wonder if that, I mean, without wanting to psychoanalyze you, Kate, I mean, you know.
True, you can try. I mean, look, I always sort of lean into the things I don't quite understand, you know, and to greater and lesser success. I mean, sometimes it's great to play things that are perhaps closer to you in ways that you're not fully cognizant of until you step into that character's shoes or that set of circumstances. But I think the thing I connected with, and I think we're connected with so many people, you know, who've seen it screened, and obviously in Venice where Jim, you know, won the Golden Lion, is that even though it's a quiet film, it really speaks to that thing that so many of us understand, is that, you know, it's that we seem to live in this trench, I guess, between who we are, who we've evolved to become in the outside world, and then who we revert to being when we're with our siblings and our parents.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking you've played a lot of extroverted characters and characters who project into the world, but you're equally good, and perhaps you do it less, but you're equally good with these outwardly timid characters and these sort of introverts. And I was wondering if, I don't know, it was a different challenge to play an introvert or someone who was a little bit more closed off in terms of their gestures and the way that they present to the world.
Yes, I think the challenge, it's always good, I find, I enjoy as an actor, not always working from the same energetic place. And I don't just mean physically or psychologically. I think it's the impact that your character has on the narrative. But I think no matter what the dynamic, internal dynamic of the character, what I'm always fascinated with is that it's what, you know, we project into the world who we wish we were rather than who we actually are. And so it's that sort of interface between those two states that I find really interesting, and that was really alive in Jim's screenplay.
Yeah, what did he tell you about why he wanted to make it? I mean, how recently had he lost his most recent parent? I think it was only in the last few years that he lost, was it his mother or...?
Yes, and I think it's also being a father, you know, which has changed him profoundly. And I think, you know, we're all daughters, sons, brothers, sisters. It's something that is a kind of a universal thing, and you don't stop being that even though your parents pass away. And it's never easy to lose your parent, no matter how and when it happens. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting. My eldest son. And a friend of his both gave me the same novel, which is for Christmas. And it was a very quiet novel. And I think that there's a resurgence of quiet stories that don't ripple the surface very much, narratively speaking, energetically speaking on the surface. But there's something quite deep going on with all of the characters. And I think that there's an interest in that.
What novel was it?
Of course, I knew you were going to ask me that. It's by David Carr, and it's about a fellow who comes back from the First World War and has to repair a fresco in a small village church. And so it's the time that it's a month in the country. And it was just so beautiful. And I found it really interesting that a 20-year-old and a 23-year-old both gave me the same book. So it's Jim's always onto something. You know, he's always got his finger on the pulse of something quite deep, I think, in all of his films, even though, of course, people always talk about the patina and the cool and the elan of the way he works, and of the man himself, you know, but he's a very deep human being.
I have to say on that, I watched this film and I was so happy to be back in a Jim Jarmusch world. Yeah. And I'd love to know what it's like being on a Jim Jarmusch set. But when I saw the sister-brother episode, the chapter, with India Moore and Lucas Sabat, I found myself, I was almost embarrassed about how much I was seduced at 54 years of age by the coolness of these two characters, these two sort of African-American brother and sister twins, and the way that they just wore black leather in a particularly Jim Jarmusch way, but in a way that, I almost felt like embarrassed because it was like a 16-year-old's reaction, but I found myself looking at them going, they look so cool.
I know,
and but he manages that so well as a filmmaker.
He does. I think it's because he's so curious about people, but so easy. I mean, surely the definition of cool is people who are comfortable in their own skin and don't mind being looked at because they're looking at the world. And, you know, there's such an intimacy and an ease to that particular part of the story. I think exacerbated by how awkward and self-conscious the two previous sections of the triptych have been.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you're pretty cool in that section of the triptych too, in a kind of, in this sort of, I don't know, normcore dowdy
way. Daggy kind of way.
Yeah. I have to ask then, with all this talk about, you know, outward appearances and needing to, I guess, recenter or revert to, I don't know, some true self, how do you manage that with your life? I mean, I'm looking at just your movements recently, you do a Cate Blanchett Googled in Google News and you're doing this, that and the other and flying around the place. Is it important for you to get back to some sense of being rooted in a true sense of who you are and not having to sort of present to the world?
Well, I mean, who are we really? I mean, how long have we got, Jason? I mean, we don't. I mean, we don't. We try and We speak, we move, we act in order to answer a problem, you know, and it may seem like it's sort of self-expression, but it's really just a process of trying to understand what the hell is going on out there. And I think that's the way I approach my work, that's the way I approach my life, you know, problems big and small. And so I don't sort of see a separation between all of those things that I'm engaged with. It seems to come from the same wheelhouse, if that makes any sense.
You work through your authenticity in the work. It's not as if you're detaching yourself
or lack thereof.
Right. Okay.
We're always trying to seek for the authentic. I mean, I think that's something I really love working with Jim. Is he's absolutely authentically himself, and I think he's interested in those people who kind of swim in that same river,
yeah,
you know, and therefore what they have to offer.
What is working on a Jim Jarmusch set like? I mean, you know, you've worked with so many different types of directors and unconventional directors.
Yeah.
But Jim Jarmusch, what's a set with Jim like?
He cares so deeply and pours so much of himself into it. He's a very tender, hilarious but very tender person, and he exposes himself, you know, emotionally, I think, quite profoundly in the work that he does, no matter how high style it is. But we didn't have a lot of time to rehearse, but Charlotte Rampling and Vicky Creeps and Jim and I just would meet in the kind of nondescript upstairs Thai restaurant opposite the hotel that we were staying in Dublin. And we would have Thai food every night and just talk about our families. And so in a way, he wants to open people up and does it in such a kind of a gentle way so that they're bringing as much of themselves and are available to whatever happens on the day. But he's very meticulous. Like each syllable, each word is so carefully chosen. The repetitions in this film are very, very deliberate. So he sort of improvises his way around things as it's being developed, you know, through conception and in pre-production. But once we're there, he's quite clear about what he wants. So you know, people often think about sort of improvisation, and he's happy to go with whatever happens on the day, but he is quite adamant about certain things.
Well, I noticed there are these through lines with different props, even like the Rolex, the idea of the Rolex watch and the cars as motifs are kind of interesting too. Yeah. Like there's a real skeleton there of symbols and signs that he's placed very carefully, you feel. Can I ask you a question about your role as UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador and producer on this sort of project of short films, including one by Mohammad Rasulov?
Yes.
And Shabanu Sadat, who's an Afghan filmmaker who I really love, who made two great movies, at least that I've seen, The Orphanage and Wolf and Sheep, and she's made something for you for this project called Super Afghan Jim.
Yes.
it's this group of films about what it's like to be in exile as an artist, I believe. But tell me about getting that together and how hands-on you were in that.
Yes, it came out of a group of us were at the Global Refugee Forum only a few years ago, and we were asked to make a pledge. And I was on the table with Koji Yenai, who just produced Perfect Days, and with Aisha Kurum, who had been formerly displaced herself. And so we were talking about, given that anthropogenic climate change and human displacement are two of the biggest crises facing us as a species. But yet they seem to be off the table in terms of the narratives we told. And then we extrapolated that further to say, well, what happens when you're displaced because of war or persecution or conflict? If you're an artist, your stories fall off the radar. We made a pledge to support and highlight the work of displaced filmmakers. And we've just had the first cohort come out. And you mentioned Shabanu, who also had her feature at the Berlin Film Festival, which was wonderful.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And so, now it couldn't have had a better reception at the Rotterdam Film Festival. And got 5 stars in The Guardian, which is always nice when they get it right.
I noticed, yes.
But they're really great, and they exist in and of their own right as short films, which is a very experimental form. I mean, that's what Coffee and Cigarettes was for Jim, you know, a series of short films that ultimately strung together as a feature.
Well, great. Well, we look forward to seeing them in Australia. They'll surely make their way here, I suspect, especially after the glowing reviews from Rotterdam. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Be great. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you, Jason.
Kate Blanchett. See her in the new Jim Jarmusch film, Father, Mother, Sister, Brother, in cinemas now. You're listening to The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso, and we come to you from the magical land of public broadcasting at ABC Radio National. If you like what you're hearing, in-depth conversations about filmmaking craft each week, remember to tell your friends and fellow screen lovers. This next film continues the themes of parents and children and delves into the cross-generational trauma of a Palestinian family. It's called All That's Left of You, and it's the story of three generations, beginning with the Nakba in 1948, which is the term Palestinians used to describe the displacement of their people after the foundation of the State of Israel. And it ends in more recent times. The story involves fathers and sons in particular, and as you'll hear, they're played by a real-life father and sons. Although the film also stars its writer-director as well, Shireen Dibas. She plays a mother in the plot's contemporary storyline, and as it turns out, she's a grieving mother for a son who's killed in a street protest by Israeli forces. The film's main focus is contextualizing this tragedy by looking at the broad sweep of history, but also the direct aftermath of this killing, which involves a dilemma about organ donation. The film approaches its subject matter in a way that offers up a diverse set of opinions within the family itself. This is a nuanced portrait of different generations, different personality types, and how various characters within one family respond in different ways to issues of occupation, grief, redemption. The film's cast pulled together in the enterprise with great distinction. American-born Shireen Dibas is a gifted director. She's an Emmy-nominated one as well. She made an excellent dialogue-free episode of Only Murders in the Building, featuring a deaf central character that I recommend you seek out. She's also directed several films, including a moving portrait of migrant suburban alienation in 2009 called Amerika. She's coming up.
Yes, Mayor.
No one ever thought any of this would happen. I'm here to tell you how it started.
Shireen Dibas, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you so much.
And I have to say congratulations on making this ambitious project. There is such a sweeping sense of history here.
Thank you.
How much is it inspired directly from your family's history or moments or stories in your family's history?
Yeah, it's not, overall, I would say it is not my family story. My father is actually a 1967 refugee. He was expelled from Palestine in 67. So he does know dispossession and displacement and, you know, the life of a refugee and living in exile. And I was born and raised in the diaspora in the U.S., but visiting Palestine often as a kid, so I would get these kind of windows into occupation. So definitely there are things throughout the film that were inspired by either my dad or experiences that I had, you know, directly traveling in Palestine, seeing my dad harassed and humiliated at borders and checkpoints. But overall, I would say the movie was really inspired by the desire to tell the story of the Nakba. And, you know, for me, you can't tell that story without it being multi-generational. And the different generations of my dad's side of the family and the ways in which our identities were shaped by Palestine, you know, even though we were living far away, we were still so impacted by everything happening that really struck me and was something that I wanted to kind of investigate in a film.
Yeah, well, in a way, the overall impression I have from this film, walking away from it, and it's very moving, is that on the one hand, it is this portrait of the macro and these pressures and various strands in broader history. And it's also about this sort of mid to close-up shot view of a family, and it's a film about how this family and history collide, really, and how that collision has all these very real effects, some of them kind of slow burning, like the effect on the heart of the patriarch, you know, who has heart problems after his experience at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially in the early days of the fledgling state of Israel, but also in a very real, impactful way. I don't mean that as a pun, when, you know, there's a character who receives a bullet to the head. And so you come away, and I think that's what the film does really effectively, is that you see history having these direct impacts on this family across time.
Absolutely.
And it reminds me of it's a kind of American classic film in some ways. It's almost there's almost something Godfather-y about it.
You know, it's funny. I've had a number of people say that. And I could see that. You know, I grew up in the U.S. watching these kinds of films and always wondering where our story was, you know, kind of watching these Hollywood epics and war films and multi-generational films. And they did in some ways, for me, I think that the structures of those films really lent themselves to this type of story. So, and I did want to bring that element to a story like this that has been denied, suppressed, erased, because I felt it to be quite subversive. So that was definitely a conscious choice. But I love what you said, because I really, as I was writing this film, I was thinking a lot about the macro versus the micro. You know, the fact that this is a movie about how history shapes people. You know, so we see history through the eyes of this family, and we see the consequences of the things that, you know, that we may know about politically, that we may have heard about, the kind of factual knowledge we may have, but we don't really understand how people were changed and families were changed and generations were changed by these different historical events. And so the film is really built so that these political events or the macro kind of form the background of the film, you know, the events in the background. And the film is really a close-up on the family, who are kind of the micros, so that we see how these different historical events and moments of violence and consequences of moments of violence really change families, you know, that violence can infiltrate the domestic space and change relationships between parents and their children and husbands and wives. So I was really kind of thinking of this macro and micro as I was writing the film.
Yeah, there's this kind of intimacy here, and you've cast yourself in the film as well, in the main thread, as it were. Tell me about that choice.
That's right. About that crazy choice. Well, it wasn't something that was obvious to me from the beginning. I think that I came closer to making that choice in prep in Palestine. So it took me time to kind of realize that this character of Hanan in the film was in many ways an extension of me, the storyteller, the kind of person who was going about making this movie and exploring my own kind of inheritance of trauma, both collective and intergenerational, and really wondering, what does it take to attempt to heal in these circumstances? What does it take to attempt to move through one's trauma and come out on the other side still like a recognizable human being to yourself? And I, at some point, realized that playing the part was really just a deepening of my role as the director in some ways, in that it was just deepening this exploration for me. And that was when I made the choice. It came out of this sort of emotional need to just go deeper in my own exploration. And I was also terrified to do it. And I'm just that kind of annoying person that like goes towards the things I'm terrified of because I somehow think that they'll help me grow as an artist.
Well, that's a great trait to have.
I really hope that they do. Yeah. I've learned a lot. That's very true. Playing this part really made me very uncomfortable and challenged me in some very important ways.
Tell me about, you say it is about a family. And of course, you do have a family on screen here. The Bakri family.
That's right.
Right? So two generations, but they're playing sort of three generations. It's Muhammad, Adam, and Saleh, especially, I really love. His work is so great. And he's fantastic. Muhammad, of course.
Very soulful.
Muhammad died after you shot it. And in a case of reality, or art reflecting reality, he also had heart problems. So that was that's very sad to hear. But they're excellent, and they're obviously a dynasty of Palestinian actors.
They are the only acting family dynasty in Palestine, and you know Muhammad is the patriarch who plays the grandfather in the film, and five of his six kids are actors who followed in his footsteps, which is really really remarkable. It was my dream to work with them. I mean, I didn't realize I'd work with so many of them in one film, but when I started writing this, it made sense to me. You know, they came to mind immediately because I thought, how else am I going to bring this to life? You know, this intergenerational portrait on screen where I need to show, you know, one character from the age of five all the way to his 70s. You know, I have to cast these different, like, you know, the casting of this film was very daunting to me. And I was thinking about it as I was writing it. And of course, the Bakri family just immediately came to mind. So it was really my dream to be able to work with them. And, you know, my only worry was, will they like the script and will they be available? You know, how can I make sure I get them? But it was incredible to work with them. You know, Saleh and Muhammad had a lot of scenes together in the 1978 portion of the film. And they brought so much nuance and depth from their own relationship. It was just absolutely beautiful to see.
They played father and son also in the kind of dramedy called Wajib that came out maybe 6 or 7 years ago that I reviewed, which was also excellent. They're just wonderful on screen together. And equally, that was another film that kind of explored the different politics of father and son. And I think what will be perhaps interesting for people to see who don't know much about the region is that political nuance in the film and the idea that Saleh, whose son dies in tragic circumstances, is not a particularly radical person. He seems to express ambivalence and perhaps even a touch of antipathy towards the kind of street level protests that his son becomes involved in. So I think that's, you know, it's a very nuanced film in many ways.
Yeah, I wanted to show kind of the different responses of different people, you know. I mean, so often Palestinians are presented as a monolith,
Yes.
But like everyone else, we have, you know, so many different opinions and I mean, many, many different loud opinions. certainly I grew up in a family with a lot of different loud opinions. So it was important for me to show that and also to show how the different generations form in relationship to what they saw and, you know, what they saw kind of happen to their parents or their grandparents. I really wanted to craft this movie to show that.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that traveling to Palestine as a child, you'd witnessed moments of humiliation that your father suffered at the hands of Israeli authorities. And that's that kind of scene, well, a scene inspired, no doubt, by those personal memories is a pivotal one in this film. It's a patrol of four Israelis and the father and son are out after curfew and the way that these Israelis, who you make a point of showing as very young and kind of quite ragtag and led by a pretty heinous bully, really, it seems, is one soldier that perhaps looks a little uncomfortable with what's going on. But under the command of this bullying officer, they proceed to belittle at gunpoint the father in a way that's revealed to be a pretty bad taste joke for them, but is causes irreparable rift between father and at that point, child son. Can you tell me about writing that scene?
You know, what was important to me was to show throughout the movie the different kinds of violence that Palestinians experience under occupation. Because it's not just physical, you know, it's psychological, it's administrative. Towards the end of the movie, we see the bureaucratic violence that Palestinians suffer. In this moment, you know, what's devastating is the consequences of this moment, of psychological violence that, of course, always there's always the threat of physical violence as there is within this scene. But what is so devastating, and many people, many audience members who see the film say to me that that scene is the most devastating scene to them in the entire film, that it's much more devastating than even the physical violence in the film. Because you see a rupture in a relationship between a father and a son. And you see a young son who really admired and looked up to his dad. And suddenly, in this moment where he sees his dad utterly humiliated before his very eyes and realizes that his dad has no power in this situation, he has no power to protect him, his opinion of his dad plummets. You know, his dad falls from grace and their relationship never recovers. It was really important to me to show this because Palestinians have been living under occupation for going on 80 years. And the consequences of living in that way are so profound. And, you know, I think this scene comes, you know, somewhat close to showing the profundity of this type of violence on people and how it can change people. But, you know, we normalize this term occupation and we use it like it's nothing. But actually, it's tremendously violent. It's tremendously destructive. And it is daily disrupting and ruining the lives of the Palestinian people, you know, through humiliation or through, you know, like the things that you see in the scene, not just the physical violence. So, and this scene did come out of a moment that I experienced as a kid. Of course, I didn't take it as far as the character in the film because I didn't live in Palestine. And I knew that outside of this place, my dad could protect me. But that moment stayed with me and it formed, you know, who I am. It made me understand really what it meant to be Palestinian. I thought about that moment so often as I was beginning to write this film. And I thought, I've got to bring this in because, you know, if this would have happened to me living in Palestine, boy, I think my reaction would have been probably a lot different.
Yeah.
Because this type of thing would be around all the time. There would be the threat of this all the time. And I would realize, you know, my parents had no power to protect me. So what authority do parents have when their kids realize they can't protect them?
Yeah, well, I think it's a nicely directed scene. In the whole film deals with, in again, quite nuanced ways and in ways that come as you don't expect, especially in the later parts of the film where we encounter the Israeli medical system. It's a film that deals with Palestinians interacting with Israel in all sorts of ways, actually. But it's fascinating for that. I do have to ask you, because I know it affected the production, what happened when the conflict in Gaza exploded after that Hamas attack? I understand you were planning to shoot in Palestine, but then had to reschedule. And
yeah, we had prepped the entire film in Palestine by that point. I had been working with my crew on the ground for about 5 months, and we were only 2 weeks away from shooting. We were planning to start shooting in late October 2023. So, you know, of course, the events of October the 7th and the event of October the 7th and everything that came after that stopped us in our tracks. And we were just in a total state of uncertainty and crisis, not knowing, you know, what's going to happen. Are we going to be able to continue making the film? Are we going to have to evacuate? We did end up having to evacuate. It became clear that we weren't going to really be able to move around. We had been planning to shoot all over the country, not just the West Bank, but also Israel proper, Haifa, Yaffa, and Tel Aviv. So, you know, moving around became dangerous. West Bank cities were being sealed off and checkpoints were closing, and there were rumors that the border was going to close. My foreign crew wanted to leave. They were scared. So we started evacuating people just a few days later, and we decided to go to Cyprus, where we had always planned to shoot a small percentage of the film. And so we thought, okay, let's start here and then we can return to Palestine. And of course, you know, the situation just escalated and escalated. So we were never really able to return. And we thought, you know, rather than focus on returning, let's just keep going. You know, we recognized at that point that the movie had just become infinitely more vital and relevant, that it was providing necessary context for how we got to where we were at that moment. And we felt it was more important to just make the film and get it out into the world sooner rather than later. I mean, I also really felt, you know, it was a very intense time. You know, we found ourselves making a movie about what was happening as it was happening. So talk about, you know, life and art kind of imitating each other. It was very surreal. So in a way, the movie for me was almost like my way of surviving this genocide that we were suddenly watching. It was just like, okay, I'm going to throw myself into this. I think a lot of us who worked on the film felt this way. We're just going to pour all of our love into this film. And, you know, it will allow us to feel a little bit less helpless as we watch this thing, you know, all of this incredible, horrific violence unfold.
I wanted to explain why we are here, what my family went through.
Shireen Dibas, I recommend you seek out her film, All That's Left of You, in cinemas now. ABC Radio National's The Screen Show is what you're listening to. I'm Jason DeRosso. Next up, Leaving Las Vegas director Mike Figgis has made a documentary about the making of Megalopolis. You might remember that was Francis Ford Coppola's 2024 passion project that fused ancient Roman melodrama with science fiction. And it starred Adam Driver as an idealistic architect at loggerheads with a corrupt and short-sighted political class. You could say the story reflected Coppola's own wranglings with the Philistines at the studios over the years. Mike Figgis, at one point in this documentary, says that any film about the making of a movie is usually about things going wrong. A great example of that, of course, is the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, Hearts of Darkness. And true enough, a lot does go wrong on the set of Megalopolis. The 82-year-old Coppola seems to be in terminal conflict with some of the huge departments working under him. His improvisational, jazzy approach to filmmaking will no doubt put a smile on the faces of film lovers, but it did end up annoying many of his collaborators, and at one point, the whole art department resigns. But it's Coppola's money, and to be fair, he's earned the right to make the movie his way. His demeanour on set, by the way, is far from confrontational. It's fascinating to watch him argue points quite fiercely, but with an underlying warmth, an ever-present desire to connect, to reach consensus. His actors all seem to respect him enormously, notably the mercurial and passionate Shia LaBeouf, who's on screen quite a lot here, and who disagrees with the maestro quite a bit. Other familiar faces include Aubrey Plaza, John Voight, and Dustin Hoffman. The documentary is called Megadoc, and it's a must-see. Mike Figgis coming up. And a warning, there's some strong language ahead.
Ready and action!
You seem to thrive on chaos.
I am confronting chaos.
This is a nightmare.
Movie making is not work, it's play. Play gives you everything.
He's got a big dream.
Just keep upping the stakes.
I know what I'm talking about. Give me what I want!
Who cares if you die broke if you made something that you think is beautiful?
Mike Figgis, welcome to The Screen Show.
Pleasure to be here, Jason.
I have to ask, first of all, I admire this film very much, and your documentary has made me want to revisit Megalopolis, and I admire your film a lot, but what's your position on Megalopolis? Can you actually view it with any kind of, I don't know, objectivity?
Not really. I mean, I've seen the film once, and that was at Cannes when I was filming, actually, Francis going in on the red carpet and all of that. And then, they gave me a seat and I sat and watched it. And then as each scene unfolded, of course, I went, oh, yeah, I remember shooting that. Oh, I didn't know it was going to go there. And, you know, so you find yourself just kind of like trying to do your own jigsaw version of what he had done, you know, and going, oh, interesting choice, you know. but, you know, looking back on the history of Francis, it's interesting that what we now consider to be all his masterpieces, you know, or certainly The Godfather and The Conversation to an extent, all had people who did not just say no to the budget, but also actually in post-production said no to this cut or whatever, you know, so you've got to make it shorter, like, but, you know, Evans would, you know, no, it's too long, you know. And then the collaboration with Walter Murch is also, so there's a series of collaborations in Francis's past that were no way diminish his genius, but actually, you know, it's just like that combination was dynamite. But if there's no one there to help you tick the boxes, let's put it that way, I think the result is Megalopolis, you know. And of course, Francis being Francis, even though he's in his mid-80s now, I'm sure he's probably re-editing it right now, you know, and doing another version of it and, you know, all that. So long answer to your question. Ultimately, I would say my admiration for the attempt outweighs anything else.
Well, you're someone like him, I think, who talks a lot and is interested a lot in cinema and in terms of pushing its boundaries and what is cinema and what could cinema be. And he's been speaking about that forever. But I do find his conversations, I mean, I find him so charismatic in this film, first of all, and so warm, even though he's having these heated arguments. And that interchange with Shia LaBeouf at a certain point, talking about Shia sort of saying this actually happens, and he's sort of saying, no, it doesn't. It's all a fabrication. Yeah. I mean, he gets quite philosophical about what film is. And I really admired that you captured that.
Mm. I made a decision going in that the only way to do this, because it came out of the blue. I had sent him an email saying congratulations on going ahead with Megalopolis, which, by the way, I had no idea what it was. I just heard that it's a film he wanted to make. And then cheekily said, P.S., if you need a fly on the wall, let me know. I heard nothing. And then he did sort of say, have you got a visa? Can you be here next month? So I jumped on. I was like, oh, my God, you know, I'm not really prepared for this. What do I do? So the first thing was like, I know I need to be lightweight. I know I need to be like no boom, no lighting, you know, just me and an assistant. This is the only way to get this, because I know Francis a little bit already. And I think that was the key thing, the fact that this little camera, You know, it meant I could be conversational and stroll up by myself without anybody's, you know, eavesdropping or anything like that. And of course, as you know only too well, particularly on a film of this scale, the waiting time is astronomical, you know. So there's going to be these endless waits, you know, between setups or waiting for, you know, Adam Driver to get out of makeup or whatever, where people are kind of frustrated, a bit bored, and they're only too happy to reminisce and talk and, you know, and like just like, you know, exchange, you know, philosophical ideas or whatever. So there was a ton of that with Francis. I mean, he loves talking. He loves talking about film, as I do, you know.
Yeah, he talks about the technical imperfection but artistic brilliance of Cassavetes, for example. Mm. And I just get the feeling, I mean, you know, that he is in a kind of cultural clash, really, with many elements of his own production, that they come from a much more technical kind of industrial mindset.
I mean, the ironies are kind of like, you know, very funny, because the very thing that he and George and everybody created, you know, the world that he now hates, he's very much part of the creation of, number one. And then he's also the victim of, as your, let's say, your fame increases and your, let's say, your buying power, there's this thing in film where, you know, bigger is better. You know, so the Ridley Scott thing, you want an army, basically, and you become a commander-in-chief, right? For personal reasons, I always hated that. I really don't like having more than like five people around me. It's just hard work running the show, right? But I think there's also an addiction to that kind of filmmaking, you know, and I found that in the past, you know, with talking to Kubrick or Bertolucci and all these people, that it's very hard for them to go back to what they know, what they really vocally say they admire, Cassavetes, you know, Irvin Kershner, whatever. You know, I kept thinking, to have the fun that you say you want to have, Francis, 10 million would have been a much more appropriate budget for you. For me, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and not 3 million just on the makeup budget. I was thinking, I mean, you know, tell the listeners, is $3 million on a makeup budget normal or justifiable?
No. But his idea was, I want the best, therefore I will pay for whatever they asked for. I mean, the camera budget, you know, the construction budget, the whole thing is just bonkers, right? And then the incremental slowing down of production that comes with this glut of very creative people. By the way, all desperately trying to do the very best they can for, you know, this legendary genius and this sort of, this awful clusterfuck of, you know, best intentions, you know, which is what ultimately I think the Megadoc actually is about, really. But if only Francis, you know, at one point, you know, I went up to him and I said, look, Francis, here's my camera. It actually shoots 4K, you know, and I'm looking at three techno cranes, all with, you know, the latest Arri on it and the team of like monitors and people with brightly colored cables that go with all of that, you know. I mean, unbelievable amount of hardware, you know.
He's very admired, though, in the end. I think it's, you haven't caught a stray comment where anyone suggested that, and that's quite interesting. I mean, he is a general, but there's something quite affable about him, even when at one point you do document a real, a momentary falling out between him and Shia LaBeouf, and then he writes a nice email to Shia. Do you think he was universally well-liked on the set?
Look, I have this theory about legend, which Francis, to me, seemed to prove. And I noticed this with certain famous actors, that particularly at an early age, if you become a legend, Francis did become a legend early on, people start treating you like a legend and you start behaving like you agree with them, which is, I think, a fatal human flaw. You know, because at the end of the day, we all die. And as somebody once crudely said, our poo all smells the same, you know. But so that kind of behavior of like, oh, a legend, how you communicate with a legend has an artificiality built into it. So it's a combination of respect or, I mean, I'd go for drinks with the gaffer and the DPs at the weekend and they'd ask me stuff like, as a director, how, you know, so they were really puzzled, having made hundreds of films themselves, of how is this jigsaw going to come together? Because they were watching all the scenes. But they didn't question the fact that it would come together. They just, because he's a legend, you know. So I think that becomes also a hindrance in communication. If you can't have a straight talk with someone, you know, like, or as we went said earlier, if there aren't a few people who will say, Francis, let's go and have a coffee, let's just talk about this, or have a fight even with Bob Evans or whoever, you know, somebody who just said, no, I'm putting, look, this is, to be kind is to be cruel here, you know, I'm telling you, you've got to snip 40 minutes out of this, you know, and change the score or whatever, you know, those people did, you know, tricky stuff. I mean, bloody hell, making any film is tricky, right? when your canvas is whatever 35 years old and ready, you know, and has had 25 rewrites, and by the time it gets there, and only you understand it. I mean, I didn't understand the script.
Yeah, it's fascinating for me to see that archival footage of Uma Thurman and other people doing the script read. I did not realize it had gotten so far along in previous iterations. Look, it has a place in my heart, that film, though, nevertheless. I mean, it's perhaps because it is so messy. I'd sooner revisit that than some better realized recent films, let's put it that way.
Jason, I think it's a really good point. You know, that goes back to something I said earlier, which is when you look at films that are flawed, but have an essential kind of originality about them. Because when you first watch a film, your main thing is your brain says, well, what's the story? I'm confused. You know, what's going on here? I don't really get it. But once you've watched it once and maybe you've read a kind of, you know, a script note thing saying this is the storyline, you know, then when you revisit the film, you're not looking for those connections anymore. You're looking for almost scene by scene, almost vignettes, you know? And on that basis, I have probably a list of 5 or 6 films which I do revisit, knowing that they're not perfect films, but no longer caring because I don't even have to watch the last 10 minutes because it was a failed attempt to kind of land the jet, you know? It doesn't really matter anymore, you know? I'm just interested what happened, you know, while it was flying, you know.
Yeah.
So I think Megapolis, for me, and who knows, as I said, there could be another iteration on the way, knowing Francis, but yeah.
Yeah, it's this flawed, fascinating beast. Mike Figgis, it's been real pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Jason, likewise, yeah.
Mike Figgis, his documentary about Francis Ford Coppola making Megalopolis is in limited release in Australian cinemas, and it's called Megadoc. That's it for another Mega Show. The producer this week was Tony Buckets Norton. I'm Jason DeRosso. You've been listening to ABC Radio National's The Screen Show. If anyone wants me, I'll be in my trailer.